The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello, and welcome to this first broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. Each week at this time, I'll be talking about current affairs and historical issues of interest. I'll be providing perspective and background, and especially historical perspective on current events and issues. Some of you may already be familiar with my work as a historian or a commentator, or as director of the Institute for Historical Review. In any case, I urge you to check out the IHR website, which is ihr.org. Some listeners today may recall a series of six broadcasts that I did with the Voice of Reason Network in April and May of 2009. Those six World Watch broadcasts are archived and can be downloaded from the Voice of Reason website. This new series is different. It'll be more topical, more freewheeling. We're getting in, as we get this new show off the ground, I'm sure there'll be some problems as we take off. But I'm also sure that with each new week, we'll steadily smooth out the rough spots and get into a steadier rhythm and tempo. So, welcome again. I hope you'll join me each week for the Mark Weber Report. Over the years, the Institute for Historical Review has often presented new information that the establishment media dismissed, but then later grudgingly acknowledged as accurate and valid. A good example of that is the case of Simon Wiesenthal. Now, Simon Wiesenthal is widely considered the foremost, the greatest, the most heroic Nazi hunter. He devoted his career in the years after World War II to, as he put it, hunting down Nazi war criminals. Well, 21 years ago, the IHR published a carefully researched article entitled Simon Wiesenthal, Bogus Nazi Hunter, that presented compelling evidence proving that this much-praised man had lied about his past and his alleged achievements. The article said that Wiesenthal's reputation is undeserved. It went on to say that this man, whom the Washington Post calls the Holocaust's avenging angel, has a well-documented record of reckless disregard for truth. The article pointed out and gave a tremendous amount of information that Wiesenthal lied about his own wartime experiences, that he misrepresented his post-war Nazi hunting achievements, and that he spread many vile falsehoods about alleged German atrocities during World War II. And the article also said that Wiesenthal is certainly no moral authority. Now, this article, which I wrote and was published in our Journal of Historical Review, was simply ignored by the mainstream media, even though the information presented was well-documented, well-founded, well-presented. In 1995, we published a follow-up article that provided additional evidence of Wiesenthal's long record of lies and deceit. And both of those articles have been posted for quite a few years, at least 10 years, on the IHR website. And it's been circulated around over that period of time. But both those articles, again, were simply ignored by establishment historians and the mainstream media. In recent months, though, the establishment media has confirmed precisely the very same points that we made 21 years ago. In Britain, an article appeared in the London Daily Mail with the astonishing headline, "Why I Believe the King of the Nazi Hunters, Simon Wiesenthal, Was a Fraud." It appeared in September of last year. The author of this article wrote this, and I'm quoting, "In my view, Simon Wiesenthal was a liar and a fraud. In fact, I go so far as to say he was one of the biggest con men of the 20th century. I spent 4 years working on a history of Nazi hunting that was published last year, and the material I gathered on Wiesenthal was enough to make me scream out loud. When I started my book, I too believed that the great man was just that, great. But when I looked at all his memoirs, biographies, and original archive material, I realized that, like so many others, the image that I had built up of Simon Wiesenthal was hopelessly incorrect. There were too many distortions and inconsistencies, too many outright lies." In Germany, the Der Spiegel magazine, which is a kind of German equivalent of Time or Music, Newsweek magazine, made much the same point. The Wiesenthal, the magazine wrote, and I'm quoting again, "used questionable methods. He took credit for the achievements of others. He concocted legends surrounding the story of the Holocaust and his own suffering. It was years before he corrected a claim he made after the war that the Nazis had used the bodies of dead Jews to make soap. Much of the other information Wiesenthal provided was wrong, such as his conclusions on the whereabouts of the Nazi concentration camp doctor Josef Mengele." Well, even more recently, here in the United States, Deborah Lipstadt, a very prominent Jewish historian of the Holocaust, was recently moved to acknowledge in an article, and I'm quoting again from her, "Wiesenthal's account of his experiences during the years of the Holocaust is clearly fabricated. Wiesenthal's claims about tracking war criminals in the post-war years are likewise riddled with exaggerations, if not outright falsehoods. Over the years, Wiesenthal repeatedly announced that he knew precisely where Mengele was. Most of these pronouncements, it seems, were mere guesses designed to win media attention." Now, even though these concessions to truth are gratifying and belated, they don't seem to have made any dent at all in the reputation or influence of the center in Los Angeles that bears Wiesenthal's name. That's the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is a very influential organization, a fierce supporter of Jewish Zionist interests, and which has a long and well-documented record of reckless propaganda for war against Israel's enemies. The Wiesenthal Center continues to be treated by the media, the major newspapers in the country, particularly the Los Angeles Times, with deference. Politicians continue to treat it very deferentially. And the Wiesenthal Center goes on, even though the truth about Wiesenthal as a liar, as a dissembler, as a completely untrustworthy man has been well established, not only, of course, by the IHR, but now acknowledged by others as well. Now, another example of the kind of leading-edge scholarship that the IHR has put out over the years involves Abraham Lincoln. A few weeks ago, newspapers in the United States and in Britain told readers that, contrary to what many have assumed for years, President Lincoln vigorously promoted deporting, or as he put it, colonizing free blacks to other countries because he was convinced that blacks and whites could not live together harmoniously in the same society. This so-called revelation, this news, was announced, for example, by the Daily Washington Times newspaper in an article headlined, "Lincoln Sought to Deport Freed Slaves." In London, an article appeared in the Telegraph, which is a very major newspaper in Britain, that told readers, and I'm quoting, "Abraham Lincoln wanted to ship free black slaves away from the U.S. to British colonies in the Caribbean, even in the final months of his life, it has emerged. a new book on the celebrated U.S. president and hero of the anti-slavery movement, who was born 202 years ago on Saturday, argues that he went on supporting the highly controversial policy of colonization. Even more recently, a widely distributed Associated Press item that appeared in quite a few newspapers across the United States reported that although throughout his presidency, Lincoln kept promoting the idea of colonization, that is, resettling blacks in foreign countries on the belief that whites and blacks could not coexist in the same nation. Lincoln went on to say that free blacks who envisioned a permanent life in the United States were being selfish, and Lincoln promoted Central America as an ideal location. This Associated Press article goes on to cite a new book that, again I'm quoting, makes the case that Lincoln was even more committed to colonizing blacks than previously known. Now, the point is that none of this should surprise careful readers of the IHR website or the Institute for Historical Review, Journal of Historical Review, which was published. 18 years ago, we laid all this out in a scholarly, well-documented article entitled The Great Emancipator and the Issue of Race, Abraham Lincoln's Program of Black Settlement. That was in 1993, and for years this article has been posted on our website. The article explained, and I'm quoting again, "While it is true that Lincoln regarded slavery as an evil and harmful institution, it is also true, as this paper will show, that he shared the conviction of most Americans of his time and of many prominent statesmen before and after him, that blacks could not be assimilated into white society. He rejected the notion of social equality of the races and held to the view that blacks should be resettled abroad. As president, he supported projects to remove blacks from the United States. This effort, Lincoln recognized, may involve the acquiring of territory and also the appropriation of money beyond that to be expended in the territorial acquisition. Some form of resettlement, he said, amounts to an absolute necessity." Now, it's gratifying to note this and to reconfirm the solidity and the relevance and importance of IHR scholarship, but as they say, it's better late than never. One of the things that this points up is that how the public views history is not based on what actually happened in history. It's based on the perception of what happened in history. And how the public perceives history is fashioned and made by what appears in our textbooks, what our teachers say, what our political leaders tell us, what motion pictures reinforce, what appears in books, and so forth. And that may or may not have a real close relationship to the actual historical events. How history is presented is based on how things are presented and controlled in the media and in the educational system. And that, above all, is not a matter of what historians or scholars determine. It's a matter of who has power in society, who has the power and the influence to shape how the public perceives history. Those are two very, very different things. The word revisionism or revisionist has gotten a bad reputation in the United States. It's often assumed that a revisionist is somebody who is distorting the real historical record for a reason of his own or for an agenda of his own, and that oftentimes revisionist is used in a derogatory way. Well, of course, all really good history is revisionist, because revisionism in objective terms simply means reassessing the past, reassessing events based on new information, on new evidence, and on new perspectives. Revisionism means the looking at the past from a skeptical point of view and being dubious and questioning of whatever the official view of history might be. Now, the vast majority of people don't really have much of a perspective like that. The vast majority of people more or less accept the view of history that's propagated and promoted in the motion pictures and television and textbooks and so forth. And if there's a contradiction between what a scholar might say and what they've heard in the mass media or on radio or television, most people will accept what they hear on television. And this is quite understandable because people are, the vast majority of people don't have the time or the temperament or the inclination to really look into these kinds of issues on their own. How history is presented in any society is really two things. History and how we look at history is, on the one hand, an academic discipline, an academic field, and historians try to be, if they're honest, they try to be accurate, they try to determine what really happened. But history is also something else. It's also a narrative, a popular mythology in any society about the past, because every society's view of its past, its heritage, is a kind of national mythos. The popular version of history tells us, to be really blunt, who the good guys and who the bad guys are, for example. It simplifies things. And it's not a scholarly thing. It's a kind of a national story, a national mythology. And there's often a tremendous contradiction between how the vast majority of people perceive the past and what actually happened, what the actual events are. And that's one of the things that we try to do, and what I'll be trying to do on this program, is to separate what actually happened, what the reality is, from what our national leaders tell us. Even many Americans who consider themselves skeptical and consider themselves independent thinkers often accept, often unknowingly, often just implicitly, without really understanding it, the built-in assumptions about society and life and so forth, about the past, that they've gotten from motion pictures, from television and so forth. One thing that really underscores this is, again, going back to revisionism, is that even though people might have a dubious notion about what revisionism is, revisionism has taken place already in America many times about very important events. Our perception of the past has changed, but people tend to accept whatever the prevailing view is rather than how it may have changed over time. Especially for those people who are old enough to remember or paid attention, the 1960s was a time of tremendous historical revisionism in our country. How American history was presented in our textbooks, on television, and so forth, underwent a profound change during the 1960s, during a period that, in many ways, was a kind of cultural revolution in American life. One book that I have read and reread, and which I recommend very highly, is a book entitled America Revised. It's written by Frances Fitzgerald, who received a Pulitzer Prize for a book she wrote some years ago about the Vietnam War. In her book, America Revised, she takes a close look at how America and America's past is perceived as presented in high school history textbooks. She makes the point that up until the 1960s, the dominant prevailing view of American history was that of a white European country. And during the 1960s, this drastically changed and was replaced by a vision or a view of America, a self-image of America, as a multiracial, multicultural society. She writes in her book that only in the 1960s did the textbooks finally end their rearguard action on behalf of a Northern European America. The texts of the 60s contain the most dramatic rewriting of history ever to take place in American school books. Fitzgerald also writes, "The mid-1960s must have been a bewildering period for the textbook companies. In the space of a year or two, the political wind veered 180 degrees. To read all the editions of the 60s texts is thus a bewildering experience. What changes is nothing less than the character of the United States. I want to emphasize this. The 1960s, this cultural revolution, brought about such a profound change in America's understanding of itself, its self-image, as reflected in high school history textbooks and, of course, in other ways as well, that the change was nothing less than, as Frances Fitzgerald points out in her book, nothing less than a change in the character of the United States. Now, one of the most influential textbooks in the United States during this, for much of the 20th century, was a history book that first appeared in 1911 and stayed in print as a very widely used secondary school history textbook up until the 1970s. From 1911 up until the 1970s, one particular American history textbook written by a man named David Saville Muzzy was by far the most influential, the most widely read, the most popular history textbook in the United States. And the America that it presented was a very, very different one than the one we're used to today and in the years since the 1960s. This history textbook, for about half a century, especially during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, was continually updated, was used all across the United States. Even though it was in print for about 65 years, during a 50-year period, a very high percentage, perhaps even a majority of American school children learned U.S. history from Muzzy's book. It's kind of a hobby of mine. I've been very interested for many years in American history textbooks. I have a pretty good collection of many of them because I'm interested in how differently over time they present American history, and the very same events, the very same chapters of history will be presented in very different ways depending on the time and the author of the book. The edition of Muzzy's book that I have is a 1953 edition entitled A History of Our Country. And it's remarkable to read this because the America that it presents is a very, very different one than the one that young people are used to today. In the beginning of this book, Muzzy writes an introductory letter to his young readers. And he lays out in this what he says is the purpose of this history textbook. He writes, "The purpose of the book is, quote, above all, to increase your patriotism by inspiring in each of you the desire and determination to do your part, to make your patria, a fatherland, more and more worthy of the reverence and love of its generations of sons and daughters to come," unquote. Well, that kind of language you won't find in an American history textbook today. It's the kind of language you might expect to appear in a textbook published in Italy during the Mussolini period, or perhaps in Britain 150 years ago, or perhaps in Germany during the Third Reich era. But to encourage in readers a love of what he calls the patria, the fatherland, in American books is a sentiment that you will not find nowadays at all. But you will find in the introduction to this book, which was by far the most influential American history textbook for about 50 years in the 20th century. A good example of how differently this textbook presents America and other textbooks too during this period of time, and how history is presented today, is to compare how Muzzy views the Ku Klux Klan in the period right after the Civil War. We're going to take a break right now, and I'll get back to that in just a minute, so please stay on, and we'll return in just a few minutes.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi vowed to fight until the end as he made his first public appearance since the international Allied operation began on Saturday. Gaddafi said his troops will be victorious in what he called a crusader battle. His address preceded a fourth night of airstrikes. Let's cross live now for RT's Paula Sleer, who's following developments in the capital, Tripoli. Paula, what more have we been hearing from the Libyan leader?
Well, Colonel Gaddafi spoke on state television on Tuesday night in what we are being told is a live address from his compound, Bab al-Azizia. Now, that compound was hit some 2 days ago by Allied airstrikes. He was incredibly angry and incredibly defiant. He called this a crusader war and said that he would not back down, that the Libyan control would make a mockery of these airstrikes. He said that Libya was leading international efforts and the international war against imperialism and despots. He also said that this was blatant aggression by fascists. Now, speaking to people here in the capital city of Tripoli, what they say is particularly frightening is that he said that they had not yet used the full might of the Libyan military machine. Now, we've been hearing from coalition leaders that they've managed to practically destroy his air force. This was denied by the Libyan leader. He hasn't spoken in public for several days now, and there were questions being asked as to where exactly he is, but we understand that he has a number of underground bunkers, and no doubt he is hiding in one of them.
Paula, there have been reports that troops loyal to Colonel Gaddafi are advancing on some Libyan cities. Are you hearing any more about that?
But what is interesting is we're hearing from these coalition leaders that their airstrikes have been successful, but they certainly haven't stemmed back the advancement of Gaddafi's soldiers on the ground. There is continuous fighting in a number of cities, the most prominent cities being the cities of Misrata and Zintan in the west and the city of Ajdabiya in the east. Now, particularly in Misrata, where there were some airstrikes, their intensive shelling and intensive fighting continues. Just yesterday, Tuesday, we're being told that 13 civilians were killed. Four of them were children from the same family. We're also being told that Gaddafi's men have taken up positions on the roofs of buildings and that they're working there as snipers, literally shooting at anything that moves on the ground. The local hospital has run out of medical supplies and is in fact turning people back. We're also hearing reports that out in the countryside, residents of various villages have been injured by several of these airstrikes. It is important that the rebel forces have not been able to advance from Benghazi, which is the heart of this rebel uprising and which was the first town that was affected by these airstrikes on Saturday. In that town, there was almost a status quo and the fighting has subdued.
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Welcome back. When we went on break, we were talking about the textbook, A History of Our Country, by David Seville Muzzy, which was, for about half a century, by far the most influential and popular secondary school history textbook used in the United States. As I mentioned, a very high percentage, perhaps even a majority of American school children learned history from this book. I had this book myself when I was a boy. I think we had it in eighth grade, but I'm not sure exactly. But I had this book myself. But you'll find much more about this and this subject of how secondary school history textbooks both shape how we look at the past and reflect the prevailing view of the past in American history, in fact in every society, in the book America Revised by Francis Fitzgerald. But I was beginning to give examples, and one of them is very differently how Muzzy presents the role of the Ku Klux Klan, for example, in the aftermath of the Civil War. Now today, American history textbooks and the mass media and so forth present the Klan in a very, very critical, negative way. But the way that the Klan is presented in the aftermath of the Civil War in this very widely used history textbook is different. I'm going to quote now from what he says in a section of the book under the heading The Ku Klux Klan. He writes, quote, "Deprived of any legal means of defense against such iniquitous government," he's referring here, to the carpetbagger and occupation governments that were set up in the aftermath of the defeat of the Confederacy in the Civil War. He writes, in defense against such iniquitous government, the South naturally resorted to intimidation. Secret organizations, chief of which was the Ku Klux Klan, took advantage of the Negroes' superstition and fear to force them back into a position of social and political obscurity. Exaggerated reports of these deeds of violence were spread through the North and used by the radical politicians to justify the tightening of military rule in the South. Unquote. Well, for Muzzy and for most Americans during this period of time, and also in the view of historians in textbooks that were in use during that time, black Americans virtually didn't even appear in American history textbooks in any formative or proactive way. They were subjects. And when Muzzy writes about the South, as he puts it, the South naturally resorted to intimidation, he means by this not everybody who was living in the southern states. He means only whites, or really white males who were living in the South. And his explanation of what he calls the natural resistance of white Southerners to carpetbag or imposed or occupation rule is, of course, very different than what we're used to today. In a passage of A History of Our Country about Puerto Rico, and he's referring to the period in which Puerto Rico was acquired by the United States in the aftermath of the Spanish-American War of 1898, Muzzy also writes, quote, "It was impossible to give statehood or even a territorial status to a people containing but 17% of literates, alien in blood and speech, and without any experience in self-government." For Muzzy, and for most Americans up until the 1960s, it was simply taken for granted that the United States was a white country, a white European country. And that's reflected in this history textbook as well. So when he writes alien in blood, he means Puerto Ricans weren't people of the same blood as the vast majority of people, as the population of the United States. In another section of this textbook about the national debate on immigration during the 1920s, Muzzy presents this question very differently than what we're used to today. He writes, and I quote, "American labor leaders were disturbed over the influx of foreigners who were accustomed to work for low wages, and patriotic citizens were alarmed at the numbers of newcomers who had no knowledge of American institutions or ideals. If we were not to become what Theodore Roosevelt called an international boarding house, some step must be taken to limit the unrestrained immigration of the pre-war days. The net result of these 1920s immigration laws has been to put a stop to the steady flow of aliens to our shores." Unquote. Well, when Muzzy writes about if we were not to become what Theodore Roosevelt called an international boarding house, or when he talks about our shores, what he means by that, and what Americans simply understood and took for granted in those days, was that the United States of America was a white country. And he talks, and the book is written for, and written from the perspective of white Americans, not of everybody who lived in the United States. One of the most remarkable treatments of this history textbook is in its section about World War II. As I said, this edition that I'm quoting from, and which I have, is a 1953 edition. And there's a section, naturally, about World War II and the American involvement in World War II. But in striking contrast to how secondary high school textbooks in the United States today treat World War II, in A History of Our Country in this edition, there is no mention of the Holocaust. The word doesn't appear. There's no mention even of persecution or killing of Jews in Europe during World War II or in the 1930s or 40s. In fact, there's not even a mention in this book that the Hitler government and Third Reich Germany was even anti-Jewish. Not even a mention. This reflected the prevailing outlook and values of the time, a view that Americans had that the misfortunes of European Jews were simply irrelevant, were very marginal, of marginal importance. That's a very, very different situation than now in the United States. In today's America, treatment of the Holocaust, of mistreatment of Jews, and so forth during World War II and by the Hitler government and by other governments in Europe during World War II is obligatory. In many states, it's required by law that children in high school and grade school be treated to large amounts of remembrance and focus on what they call the Holocaust and what's called the misfortunes and travails and death and suffering of Jews in Europe during World War II. Now, as I mentioned, this all changed drastically during the 1960s. There was a methodical, well-organized campaign to rewrite American history textbooks. And this is reflected in since then, for example, as Frances Fitzgerald points out in her book, America Revised, the obligatorily multicultural history textbooks that have been in use ever since present, as she writes, non-white minorities seem to have hero figures and leaders, which European groups do not. This is an indicative, a very crucial aspect of American history textbooks in recent years. Hispanic Americans, Latinos have people like Cesar Chavez, blacks have people like Martin Luther King, but white people in America no longer have any leaders that represent explicitly their interests. I want to take a few minutes to look at some recent current events and put that in some perspective and comment on those things. Well, the big news in the last week, probably internationally, has been the attack on Libya by the United States and by other countries because of intervention in the civil strife. Somewhat, it's like a civil war going on in Libya. The U.S. intervention there is hypocritical, and it establishes a very dangerous principle, one that the United States would not want to have applied to its own country. The U.S. intervention in Libya on the basis that civilians are trying to be protected is so hypocritical, it's really astonishing. During the American Civil War, Britain or France had sent troops into invaded the United States in order, as they might have claimed, to protect civilians in that conflict. Americans would have regarded it as simply outrageous. The Gaddafi government has a lot of there's a lot of things bad with the government. There's a lot of things bad with a lot of governments around the world, but for the United States to intervene in what is an internal conflict in that place is an example of the kind of arrogance of power that we've seen over and over in American history, especially in the 20th century. During World War II, Woodrow Wilson claimed that American troops were going to war in World War I on the side of Britain and French forces, not so that the Allies could win, but to make the world safe for democracy. They were getting rid of a bad guy, supposedly at that time the Emperor of Germany and his government. In the aftermath of the war, the results were so disappointing, were so far removed from the claims that were made to intervene, the American people were disgusted, and the U.S. Congress, reflecting the popular will at the time, enacted a series of neutrality laws to try to prevent the same thing from happening again. But then in the late 1930s, the beginning of the 1940s, President Roosevelt pushed for American involvement in the war going on in Europe between Britain on the one hand and Germany on the other, again justifying it with all sorts of high-sounding slogans and pretexts about protecting civilians. But the hypocrisy of the U.S. intervention in Libya is also shown up by the indifference of the United States toward the death of civilians when Israel invaded the Gaza Strip several years ago, and when Israel has invaded Lebanon on several occasions, resulting in large numbers of civilian deaths, larger than the number of civilians who have died thus far in the Libya campaign. But the overriding consideration of the U.S. government, whether it is the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, or the Barack Obama administration, has been what's good and what's in the interests of Israel. What's good for Israel and is just a primary consideration, as American presidents have made clear time and again. The result of all of this has been a blatant double standard that permits Israel to carry out policies that, if committed by any other government, would be regarded as completely outrageous. Another event that took place recently that deserves some comment was a large rally in Latvia, a small Baltic country. On the 16th of March, more than 1,000 people gathered in Riga, the capital, to honor the memory of Latvians who fought during World War II in Waffen-SS units, the so-called Latvian Legion, on the side of Germany and the other Axis forces during World War II against the Soviet Union on the Eastern Front. Now, this rally is an embarrassment for many Americans, because the background on this is that for millions and millions of people in Europe, German forces during World War II were not oppressors, but were liberators. They were welcomed as liberators from Soviet tyranny and oppression, not only in Latvia, but also in Lithuania, Estonia, and perhaps most of all in the Ukraine. As the tide of war changed in Europe after the defeat of Stalingrad in beginning early 1943, the Germans began recruiting legions of volunteers from many countries in Eastern Europe, including Latvia, to fight against the Soviet Union to preserve the freedom of the people against Soviet tyranny. And thousands and thousands of Latvians, but also Estonians, and large numbers of Ukrainians, and even Russians volunteered to fight with Germany against the Soviet Union. What this underscores is the very different way that many people around the world, and especially in Eastern Europe, view World War II as compared to the way that it's presented in the American media. In this country, our school books and our political leaders and our motion pictures present World War II as the good war between the good guys, the United States of America, and the bad guys, the Nazis and Hitler. This view is not merely simplistic and even childish, it's also incorrect. It's wrong. It's not true. America's most important military ally in the largest military conflict in history, World War II, was the Soviet Union. By any objective standard, the Soviet Union was the most tyrannical and oppressive regime in the world at the time. The number of victims of Joseph Stalin and his regime is estimated by most historians as something like 20 million, far greater than the number of victims estimated or claimed to be the victims of the Third Reich government and the Hitler government. But the Soviet Union, as tyrannical and as oppressive as it was America's main military ally during World War II. The second most important military ally of the United States during World War II was the British Empire. No regime in history has held as more people under oppression against their will as did Britain during the 20th century. And millions of people in what is now India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Malaysia, and large parts of Africa were held under British rule against the wishes of the people. And this was, nonetheless, the second most important military ally of the United States during World War II in a war that is presented and was presented to the American people as a great crusade for freedom and justice. Another thing that happened just recently was a dispute in Germany over an effort to build a monument in Germany to the victims of oppression, expulsion, and so forth in the aftermath of World War II who died as refugees or expellees from large parts of Eastern Europe. Jewish groups have objected to efforts to build a monument to the estimated 2 million plus Germans who lost their lives as expellees and refugees in World War II, because the whole notion of German victims of World War II is one that is not really permitted in the American media and is inconsistent with the view that's reinforced repeatedly in the American media about that conflict. For many years, the dean of the White House Press Corps was a woman named Helen Thomas. She was for many years a correspondent, chief writer for in White House, covering the White House for the United Press International. Last year, she was suddenly fired from her position with the UPI because she had made some remarks in a interview about how the Jews in Israel should leave and go back to the countries they came from, and the land should be turned over again to the Palestinians, who were the people who had been living there for centuries. Well, interestingly enough, she gave an interview just the other week about all of that, and was asked if she had just spoken out of turn or if she knew what she was doing. Well, Helen Thomas is a feisty woman. She's getting on in years now, but she was completely unapologetic and defiant in an interview she recently gave with Playboy magazine about the whole incident. She said she's not sorry for the remarks she made, and she went on to underscore and strengthen a lot of the points she had made in previous interviews and comments about the power of the Jewish lobby, the Jewish Zionist lobby in the United States. She said, "I knew exactly what I was doing. I was going for broke." She said that I had reached the point of no return. You finally get fed up. Well, in the interview, Helen Thomas went on to say that, and I'm quoting, "The Jews are using their power, and they have power in every direction. Power over the White House, power over Congress. Everybody is in the pocket of the Israel lobbies, which are funded by wealthy supporters, including those from Hollywood. Same thing with the financial markets. There's total control. It isn't the 2%, that is, Jews in America make up about 2% of the total population. She says it's real power when you own the White House, when you own these other places in terms of your political persuasion. Of course they have power." Well, this point about the enormous disproportionate power wielded by the organized Jewish lobby in the United States is one that needs to be stressed over and over, because the result, the impact of this power has tremendous consequences in every aspect of American cultural and political life and social life as well. One good example of that was the vote in the United Nations Security Council a few weeks ago, in which 14 members of the Security Council voted to approve a resolution condemning Israel for its illegal settlement building on the in the occupied Palestinian West Bank territories. This resolution condemning Israel for these actions was supported not only by other members of the Security Council, but by more than 100 members of the United Nations General Assembly. The only country to vote against this resolution was the in the Security Council was the United States of America, which vetoed it. On this issue, there is a worldwide consensus that Israel's policies of oppression, occupation, and of illegal settlement building is wrong. There's a worldwide consensus about this. It's contrary even to the stated policy, anyway, of the United States of America. But the reality is that U.S. foreign policy is made not in the interests of the American people or of humanity, certainly not in the interests of Palestinians, but it reflects above all the power of the organized Jewish community in the United States. And the U.S. veto in the Security Council of a resolution that is in accord with what United States policy says it is, and what the world consensus is, and what objectively is international law, is a striking example of the double standard, the hypocrisy of the United States when it comes to foreign policy in the Middle East. That again reflects not what's good for America, but what's good for and in the interests of this very powerful lobby. When Barack Obama was elected president, the one thing that he promised, and certainly his followers expected, was going to be change, real change in the United States. And in the years, in the time since Barack Obama has been president, his critics have ceaselessly emphasized and portrayed Obama as a radical, dangerous shift in American policy. Day after day, Rush Limbaugh, for example, keeps emphasizing that Barack Obama is a dangerous radical. He calls him, and has been calling him, even a fascist. But the truth is very different. As the recent vote by the United Nations Security Council shows, and the U.S. attack against Libya shows, certainly in foreign policy and in so many aspects of domestic policy as well, what's remarkable about the Obama administration is not how much things have changed, but how little they've changed, how much continuity there is in the policies of the Obama administration compared with the predecessor, George W. Bush, and even earlier. The Barack Obama administration has shown once again that with regards certainly to the Middle East and in so many ways, the power of the Jewish Zionist lobby is undiminished, and that the Obama administration is completely subservient to that, as Helen Thomas points out. Well, that concludes this first broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. I hope you'll join me next week for the next installment. In the meantime, check out the IHR website at IHR.org. Thank you for being with me. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, Reason Radio Network. .com.